Impeachment is underway in the Senate, but the rules governing the trial aren't made for TV.
Even the most committed news junkies are probably going to have a hard time staying focused on this trial.
I'm Arun Vanigopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 21st, how impeachment is likely to play into the Democratic primaries. Also on the show, we'll hear how black and brown voters in Iowa are feeling about the Democratic candidates.
They don't really answer questions about what specific thing are you going to do for the black community. They always say they want to represent those who are underrepresented, but they aren't explaining how they're going to do that.
Plus, a look at the particularly high barriers that exist for people of color seeking mental health care.
Fewer than 4% of licensed psychologists are actually people of color. So when you're looking specifically at psychologists who are able to provide mental health needs, the number is incredibly low.
And we'll check up on Puerto Rico and talk with my friend Andrea Bernstein about her new book, American Oligarchs. Whew, a lot to get to. Let's hit it, people. Take a trip to Iowa with me. So it's crunch time for the Democratic candidates attempting to campaign for Iowans' support. Yesterday, many of the leading Democrats were in Des Moines for one of the most important forums for communities of color, called the Brown and Black Forum. The Politics with Amy Walter team was at that event, and they asked attendees who they're supporting in the race.
You know, right now, I think I'm deciding between Senator Warren, Senator Klobuchar, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
I'm very, very proud of the women that are running. I think they're holding their own. Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren, I mean, they're awesome.
I do have one particular in mind, which is Bernie Sanders.
Pete Buttigieg would be my number one, and Amy Klobuchar is my number two. Third choice probably would be Joe Biden.
We'll hear more about that forum in just a moment, but we're going to start with impeachment and how it's playing out in Iowa. Joining me now from Des Moines, Amy Walter, host of Politics with Amy Walter here on The Takeaway every Friday, and national editor of the Cook Political Report. Amy, how is Iowa?
It's very cold, Arun. Very, very cold.
Oh.
Yeah, they don't tell you
I'm sorry.
What it feels like, but it's great. I'm really glad to be here.
All right. Amy, yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell released a draft of the resolution outlining the rules he'll set for the Senate impeachment trial. I'm curious, how do those rules align with what the president's legal team wants out of this trial?
Well, it seems to me that the president's legal team wants this over as quickly as possible. If it were up to them, they would like the whole thing to be dismissed pretty quickly. I don't think we're going to see that. There aren't enough Republicans, nor do I think the majority leader would sign up for that. But what we do see is a process that is going to be very condensed, where the House impeachment managers, the Democrats, are going to be making their case for 2 days, but it will go over the course of about 12 hours a day. And then the Republicans get their opportunity, the president's defense attorneys. And then we see where we go from here. The fact is, I think, honestly, what we've been seeing and hearing from Republicans in the Senate is that there's not a whole lot of movement on whether they think the president should be convicted. At the end of the day, this is about two things. The first is, are there enough votes in the Senate to convict the president? And the answer is no. Democrats would need to get 20 more Republican senators on board. I just don't see that happening. Nothing's impossible in this world, but this seems as close to impossible as we can get. The next is, will this trial impact opinions of the president enough so that it could have a political impact on him? And again, that suggests that voters are going to be tuning into a process that they've already pretty much made up their minds about, and a process that could, because of how this is set, could drag on into the wee hours of the morning. Even the most committed news junkies are probably going to have a hard time staying focused on this trial.
So how much does it matter, even if the Republicans finally do back the president through this trial, if Democrats and some of these sort of middle ground sort of senators from the Republican side do push for testimony from, say, John Bolton or Lev Parnas? How much do you think that does impact voters in places like Iowa, where you are?
Yeah, I don't know that people are paying as much attention to the details of the kinds of people who are getting put forward as potentially those of us who do this for a living are. The other piece I think that's really important to appreciate and understand is, I think for voters, they've kind of made up their mind about how they feel about this president. In fact, they made up their mind about how they feel about this president quite some time ago, even before we started talking about Ukraine and impeachment. And I think to really move the dial on voter opinion on impeachment, there's going to need to be something that implicates the president directly, either something he said, something that was caught on tape, something that he wrote, and that people within his orbit having those conversations, I still think is not quite the game changer that many folks think it is or think it could be.
So the voters that you're interacting with in Iowa, are many of them even bringing up the fact that the impeachment trial is happening right now?
Right. This is a really good point. They are not. Impeachment to them is not something that they are paying a great deal of attention to, in large part because all the Democrats are aligned on this issue. There's no difference between any of the Democrats running for president and how they feel about impeachment. What voters here are looking for is the differences between the candidates on issues that are really driving them. And so this issue of electability, the issue of who can stand up against Donald Trump, who has my best interest in mind, who has our community's best interest in mind, all of these are what are really gnawing at voters here. The most recent polls suggest anywhere from 50 to 60% of Iowa Democrats who say they're going to go to these caucuses are undecided right now. And from talking to people, just the little while we've been in Iowa, you can definitely feel that. People are deciding not just between two candidates, but sometimes between three and four different candidates.
Yesterday, you attended the Brown and Black Forum, which is aimed at issues affecting Black and Latino voters in Iowa. And you spoke with Cassandra Bragg from Des Moines, who said she's underwhelmed by how most of the candidates are talking about issues that matter to communities of color.
I've heard a lot of the candidates just bounce around. They don't really answer questions about what specific thing are you going to do for the Black community. They always say they want to represent those who are underrepresented, but they aren't explaining how they're going to do that. It's just talking points. So I'm just really trying to see and wrap my head around what they are going to do for Black communities and people of color. Because in all honesty, all I've heard was Bernie Sanders say things about the Black community and what he's going to do. So I've had my eyes on him, but that's not the only candidate I have my eyes on.
Amy, is that concern that attendee Cassandra Bragg mentioned something that you're hearing from others who were at the forum?
I think that's a fair assessment. And we were up actually the day before in a town called Waterloo, Iowa, which is the city in Iowa that is the most diverse. And I think it's African-American population there, somewhere around 16%. And we talked to two community leaders there who have different opinions about the candidates. One is supporting Pete Buttigieg, has endorsed him. The other has supported and endorsed Joe Biden. They have different reasons for why they chose these candidates. But I think it goes to the heart of what we heard there from Cassandra, which is a sense of worry that they're going to pick a candidate that may sound good, but may not be able to deliver. And I think there's also a big difference, we've seen this nationally too, between expectations of younger voters, Cassandra was in her 20s, and older voters. And it is along these lines of what can you deliver? What can you do for us? How can we trust that you're not going to treat us like every other politician has treated us? For younger voters, the real concern is that these candidates, once they get in office, are just not going to pay attention to their issues. They're not going to follow through on the promises that we're making. For older voters, this issue of electability becomes much more important, that the number one issue is defeating Donald Trump. Everything else comes second. And so that is, as I said, it's going on in Iowa, but it's not much different from what we're hearing and seeing across the country among Democrats.
Amy Walter is the host of Politics with Amy Walter here on The Takeaway every Friday and national editor of The Cook Political Report. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Arun.
Stay warm.
Thank you.
We're continuing with our conversation on the upcoming Iowa caucus with a look at the Brown and Black Presidential Forum, the oldest presidential forum focusing on issues important to communities of color. Yesterday, 8 Democratic candidates took part in the forum, which took place in a state where more than 90% of the population is white. Many attendees, including my next guest, went to advocate for issues that were important to their own communities. Sarah Carpenter is a parent and organizer with Powerful Parents Network, and she traveled to attend the Iowa Forum from Memphis, Tennessee. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah, what were the main issues that the candidates were asked about at the forum?
They was asked about everything but what we went there to hear about, and we went to hear about education. And nobody talked about education. They talked about uniting families, healthcare, and all this is important to us, but nobody is talking about education.
And so why do you think that education is particularly important in a forum like this, which is focused on Black and Brown people?
Because Black and Brown people deal with the inequities of education in their communities. I know where I come from, our kids doing, as I talk to people around the country, it's the same all over the country. Education is in trouble in America.
And do you place the blame in terms of avoiding this issue or ignoring it, rather, on the moderators or on the candidates themselves?
I blame the candidates themselves because even if the moderator don't say nothing, they should say something about it. If you can talk about college and college debt, you know, getting rid of college debt for college students, you can talk about K-12 education because that's what's in trouble. Our kids not even making it to college. And when they make it, the school system is such a overall, what the school system is like, so messed up, I'll say. So our kids don't even make it to college. And if they do make it, they got to take remedial classes, especially in the urban Black and Brown communities.
We've seen a number of candidates of color drop out of the race in recent weeks. Leon Castro, Cory Booker, and also Kamala Harris. What does it mean to you that these candidates of color have been dropping out?
It bothered me, but I mean, I don't know why they dropped out, but it bothered me because I was looking at them. You know, I was watching them, and a lot of people of color was watching those people, and it bothered me for them to drop out.
What does the nearly all-white lineup of candidates in Iowa tell us about the Democratic Party right now?
Well, it's been that way this is not the first time it's been that way. So color don't really matter. It's about what you do for the people. And people, when we go to these places, we just want our voices to be heard. And it seemed like nobody wanted to hear what we got to say. So the color is not the issue with me. It's that listening to the people that you go in there to serve. You're not just serving a certain group of people. You're serving a whole country of people.
And how do you plan on doing that, given that you've left this forum, this seemingly important forum, and you've been disappointed now that you're headed back home? What do you plan on doing?
We're going to keep reaching out, keep reaching out, keep reaching out. We reach out through Twitter to these people. We reach out. We go to these different forums, and we're going to keep showing up. Somebody will listen. I truly believe that.
Sarah Carpenter is a parent and organizer with Powerful Parents Network. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Iowa.
There are a lot of barriers to mental health care in the United States. Insurance, cost, availability of therapists or psychiatrists, and on and on. For people of color, these barriers can be much higher, and there's something else in the way.
Fewer than 4% of licensed psychologists are actually people of color. So when you're looking specifically at psychologists who are able to provide mental health needs, the number is incredibly low.
That's Dr. Joy Harden Bradford. She's a licensed psychologist. And what she's saying there is that for people of color, especially Black would-be patients, it can be difficult or impossible to find a therapist who understands the experiences they bring to the table. And that can be a major deterrent to seeking care in the first place, as well as getting care that actually works. Takeaway host Tanzina Vega spoke with Dr. Joy and Imadi about the lack of Black therapists and what's keeping more people from getting into this line of work.
I think one of the main things is that it takes an incredibly long time. So you're looking at least 10 years of school plus additional training. And even after you have received your PhD or PsyD, you still have to do another 1 to 2 years of training under someone else's license before you can operate independently. So when you're looking at like finances and who really is able to be in a position to be able to do that much school and to, you know, support themselves and maybe a family even afterwards, you may be cutting off a lot of people who economically just could not be able to do something like that.
Dr. Joy, do you also find maybe that there is a cultural element, or at least there has been maybe in the past, a cultural element to not wanting to be involved in mental health services? I think, you know, I'm Latina. I know that in our own community, there has historically at least been some reluctance to getting involved either as a patient in this line of mental health. So do you think cultural issues play into it, or is it really just a question of access to education?
Well, I definitely think that there are some cultural issues when it comes to seeking services. I have found that far less in terms of people like wanting to be therapists. I think that there's actually a lot of interest, you know, in younger students I see who are interested in psychology and exploring it. But I do think the access to being in an educational program, and not to mention the educational programs themselves, are sometimes very difficult. So just like we think about the microaggressions that exist in any other work place, sometimes there are a lot of microaggressions in graduate programs. So they are not always the most welcoming for students of color to even participate in.
Imadi, you started the online space Depressed While Black. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, originally, Depressed While Black started as my thesis at Columbia University for my nonfiction creative writing program. And I didn't know any other Black person who was dealing with depression. And so it was a way for me to basically chronicle how I'm trying to survive and live dealing with clinical depression and chronic suicidal thoughts. But it was also a way to find out who else is out there and kind of try to create that sense of community.
How did that sense of community come about? Because it is very difficult, particularly in communities of color, to talk about this and to feel that there's, that you're safe talking about it. So how did you see the community begin to grow?
It's just the more that I shared my story on Twitter, on Facebook, on Tumblr, there were just more people just saying, me too, I'm going through this too. And in the beginning, the challenge that I experienced and the challenge that my community experienced was just kind of the silence or the apathy that some of our loved ones had when it comes to us asking for help. The first time that I told my mom that I'm going to therapy, she told me, did I pray about it? And I said, yes. And she said, you know, well, did you have your pastor pray about it? And I said, yes. And it was kind of a shock to her to realize that you can have a robust spiritual life and still deal with mental illness. And so a lot of us were trying to find people who were not demonizing our condition, who were not saying that our condition is the result of some sort of spiritual deficiency. But someone, we were looking for people that said, I feel it too, and that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with us.
Dr. Joy, do you find that in your practice with patients that you see, patients of color in particular, that faith or religion, which can sometimes be helpful, can also be a hindrance to people wanting to seek mental health care?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm really glad that Imadi shared that story, because I think that that is so many people's experiences, especially in talking with family members. And there has been a very common misconception that mental illness comes from a weakened faith relationship, or there's something that you're not doing, quote unquote, correctly in terms of your faith relationship, when, of course, we know that it is not connected to that at all, that people in all walks of faiths, independent of a spiritual practice, can struggle with mental illness.
Are there other things, Dr. Joy? We talked a little bit about faith here and somewhat about cultural issues. Are there other things that keep people of color from asking for mental health services?
Well, I think finances are another huge issue, you know, and coupled with finances, I think just the managed healthcare system is very difficult to navigate. And so, you know, if you are looking for a therapist who accepts your insurance, it may be difficult to find someone who is still accepting that insurance plan. And then if they're not, then cost can be an issue because, you know, therapy ranges sometimes between $75 to $250 per session. So when you're looking at your budget for the month, it may come down to like, okay, can I afford to go to therapy or can I afford to put food on the table? So I think finances and health insurance are another barrier to access.
Imadi, that's something that comes up a lot when I talk to just, you know, friends and people who have been trying to access healthcare, that increasingly mental health providers don't offer health insurance options. And it's even more difficult if you're looking for someone who takes insurance. When you finally went to a therapist, did you have that experience? What was it like for you?
It actually was a scary experience for me. At the beginning of me asking for help, I was on a Los Angeles highway speeding, wanting to die. And it kind of gave me a huge wake-up call that I needed to get help. And so I was a USC grad student at that time, and both of the counselors told me that I need to quit school and get a police escort to the hospital. So I wasn't really introduced to therapeutic services. I was basically introduced to a punitive system when it comes to me asking for help. And so I do want to note that that some Black folks that are asking for help, we're not even getting to the therapeutic part of the mental health system. We're getting into the incarceration system. And so a lot of times we're getting filtered out of the services that we need the most. So I pretty much had to negotiate with these therapists and said, you know, I don't want to go back home, but I do want to get help. And eventually we settled on getting a therapist because I couldn't afford outpatient therapy. So some of the challenge is the fact that we're getting funneled into the incarceration system. We're getting, you know, low wage jobs that don't include health insurance. And so what I experienced when I was living in New York in the summer of 2018, I didn't have health insurance. I had to use OpenPath, which is a great directory of low cost therapists. And so, but some of those therapists sometimes aren't necessarily offer the treatment modalities that we need. Some folks, Black folks, are dealing with what I have, which is borderline personality disorder, which requires a particular type of treatment modality, which is dialectical behavioral therapy. And so the challenge also is not having health insurance and not being able to afford some of the therapists that can offer some of the really in-depth treatment modalities that are needed.
You mentioned the modalities, the different type of treatment options, and you're very knowledgeable about what issues you're dealing with specifically and then what treatment you need for that. Where, Imadi, does race play into this? Is it important for you to make sure that your therapist is also Black?
Yeah, race plays a huge role because sometimes our symptoms are not considered symptoms. They're considered something that maybe we're making it up in our head. You know, maybe when that coworker said an insensitive comment to us, sometimes what I heard in the past when I had a non-Black therapist is that that therapist kind of turned into like almost like an investigative or a defense attorney. And so they're grilling me on like, are you sure this happened? Are you sure they said that? Are you sure you're having, maybe you're having a bad day? It was almost like I was made to prove that racism exists, that I was dealing with this racial incident at work. And so it was so hard for me to say, hey, like, I want this therapy to be a safe space where my experiences as a Black woman are not questioned as if it doesn't exist. And that was a huge challenge for me dealing with a non-Black therapist.
Dr. Joy, we know that healthcare disparities exist, particularly among racial lines. What is it, in your view, that makes it so important for Black people to have access to Black therapists in particular?
Well, I think just as Imadi has mentioned, just the idea that therapy should be one of the few safe spaces that you may have in your life. And so, you know, for people across the board really have difficulty making that first call to talk with the therapist. And so when you finally work up the courage and the nerve to make that call, and then you go to an experience that's invalidating, it makes it much more likely that people are not going to try therapy again. And so it's important for people to have experiences and spaces where their authenticity and their experiences are not questioned. And I think that is why so many Black people are looking for therapists who are also Black.
I mean, should someone stop looking if they can't find therapists of color? What do they do if they're not coming up with that? Is any therapy better than the best therapy that you think you might need?
I tend to think so, yes, because I don't think, you know, of course, there are definitely non-Black therapists who do create invalidating experiences. That definitely happens. But then there are also some great therapists who are not Black. And so I think it is important, you know, if ideally you would love to work with another Black therapist, but your search is difficult and you're just not able to get that for whatever reason, I do think it is important to explore other opportunities, namely looking for someone who has the expertise in the area that you're struggling with, and to be very open with that person and talking about issues around race and culture. You know, some therapists are perfectly willing and, you know, excited about having that kind of conversation and want to do what they can to make sure that you do have a good experience with therapy. So I think if you can't find what you're looking for in terms of race and culture, then it's important to find someone who has the expertise and then share any concerns you have about microaggressions with that therapist.
Imadi, in your experience, I mean, are you noticing people in your own peer group either talking about wanting to access therapy more, talking about mental health issues more? Because I feel like there has been a shift, particularly among younger generations of people and women of color in particular, who are talking about these issues. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I think that there is a huge cultural shift that's happening. I feel like I'm a part of the first generation of Black people that are openly saying they're going to therapy. I mean, definitely Black folks have been going to therapy for a long time, but I have not witnessed us actually communicating, you know, loudly that we're doing it in such an affirming way. And I think definitely Dr. Joy's is a huge part of that movement. I mean, Therapy for Black Girls, the directory, it's a huge game changer. Before, you know, the most that I can do to try to find a Black therapist is to go to Psychology Today. You know, you select African-American amongst the choices. But, you know, there was also a lot of white therapists in that list. So, you know, there really wasn't dedicated spaces where Black people can find therapists the way that we do now. And I think it's amazing. Even my mom, I mean, she has complete turnaround. She went from, you know, not thinking I need therapy to helping me pay for therapy. So it's a huge cultural shift that is happening as we are like loudly saying, you know, that Black people are worthy of mental health care.
Dr. Joy, any closing thoughts on that, in particular what white therapists could do better if they're treating patients of color, particularly Black patients?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's really important for white therapists to be able to name any concerns that might be existing in the space. So I know a lot of times people want to say like, oh, I'm not going to bring it up unless the client brings it up. But I think when the therapist actually brings it up, it makes it so that that issue is talkable, so to speak. So if I go to you and you know, you say like, hey, I know that culturally we're different and I just want to let you know that it's okay to talk about any things. I'm human. I may make mistakes. Please let me know if there's something that I do that feels insensitive, and to really allow space for that conversation, I think is really important. You don't have to wait until the client brings up something to make sure that that issue is okay to be discussed in your space.
Dr. Joy Harden Bradford is a licensed psychologist and host of the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. And Imadi Bora is a writer and mental health advocate and the creator of Depressed While Black. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The road to recovery in Puerto Rico has hit yet another speed bump. Over the weekend, a video went viral on social media showing a warehouse full of unused disaster supplies in the city of Ponce. It's one of a number of communities still reeling from the series of earthquakes that devastated the island in recent weeks. Following public fallout from that footage, Puerto Rico Governor Wanda Vasquez Garcet fired several government officials, including the island's emergency management director. She also announced an investigation looking into the mismanagement of the aid at the Ponce warehouse and others like it on the island. For more on this, we're joined from San Juan by Arelis Hernandez, a correspondent for The Washington Post. Arelis, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
What exactly did they find in this Ponce warehouse?
Everything. What did they find? There were cots inside. There were propane tanks that people could have used to, you know, cook outside. There were inflatable mattresses, diapers, and tons and tons and tons of expired bottled water.
How long have these supplies been sitting there?
Looks like they date back to at least the months after Hurricane Maria. It's unclear why they were there. It's unclear why they were still sitting there in the situation that Puerto Rico now finds itself in with these earthquakes. There's been an investigation that's been ordered by the governor, which she said is a normal occurrence, but certainly does raise some eyebrows here in Puerto Rico.
Is it possible there's lots of other warehouses just like this one that are sitting there with unused supplies?
That's the allegation so far. Yesterday, I talked to a spokesman for the National Guard. It looks like there are at least one other warehouse. And, you know, keep in mind, there are FEMA warehouses where this stuff is pre-stocked for disasters. And then there are other warehouses, which are the ones in question, managed by the central government.
So clearly, this anger is not just about a warehouse. Well, this is really a built-up sort of frustration on the part of people who live in Puerto Rico, correct?
Absolutely. No, this is part of this ongoing narrative of government either incompetence or corruption, right? It's unclear where the incompetence ends and the corruption begins with Puerto Rican top-level state officials. And so people, you know, they've been through Maria. That was a traumatic experience. You know, there was a politicizing of disaster relief that happened from the very beginning. And it seems like some of that is still continuing to happen.
Are we expecting to see widespread protests yet again?
I've learned from the last set of protests not to underestimate Puerto Ricans when it comes to political unrest. It seems as though there could be at least one other big protest. Ricky Martin last night tweeted that he would be out here soon to join folks in, you know, denouncing this latest scandal involving the unused disaster aid.
Last week, President Trump signed a major disaster declaration, though that came with some restrictions. What do those restrictions mean for the aid?
I think it's still unclear. I think they're going through some of these requirements right now. What I'll quote to you is what the former housing secretary here in Puerto Rico, he just lost his job like a day and a half ago. But what he was mentioning, when it comes to this federal aid, from the very beginning, it was about 6 pages of regulations. Now it's more than 106 pages of regulations that, you know, people are trying to work through and analyze.
Given the fraught relationship between President Trump and the island, how do locals feel about the federal response or the lack of it?
When we talk about the federal response, we have to talk about it in sort of 3 different ways, because there was Hurricane Irma that started, then Maria, and now the earthquake. And then there's the disaster recovery funds, which is still what a lot of people and municipalities are waiting for. That flow of federal money has been extremely slow for a number of reasons. Although if you ask FEMA and the recovery czar here in Puerto Rico, they'll tell you that these things are starting to move now. And then you have the earthquakes, right? For the most part, I think people are, you know, generally satisfied with the federal response because, you know, there were lessons learned. A bunch of material was stockpiled ahead of time. You saw National Guard troops on the ground. That being said, it's a different disaster, but it's still unclear, you know, what the federal government and Puerto Rico are going to do in the long term, because there are people almost 3 weeks later still sleeping outside.
Arelis Hernandez is a correspondent for The Washington Post. Arelis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find all of the Takeaways coverage on Puerto Rico online at thetakeaway.org/Puerto Rico. As the Senate impeachment trial begins, more evidence is emerging about President Trump's effort to pressure the government of Ukraine to pursue investigations that would help him politically. The president is no stranger to using his influence to seek favors. It's a strategy that is not out of the ordinary in the world where he made his fortune, New York real estate. My friend and colleague Andrea Bernstein has been documenting the world of corruption and favoritism in New York politics for decades as a reporter for WNYC. She's now the co-host of the podcast Trump Inc. from WNYC Studios and ProPublica, and author of the new book American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. I sat down with Andrea to talk about her book, and I began by asking her about the role of federal money in the early business ventures of both Fred Trump and Joseph Kushner.
Both Fred Trump and Joe Kushner, Jared Kushner's grandfather, were builders. At a time in American history when the government was pouring money into housing in a variety of direct and indirect ways. So one of the things that it was doing was making federally backed loans much easier to get, which of course meant that the financing was unlocked and that people could get mortgages and build homes. The Federal Aid Highway Act was passed in the Eisenhower era, and this put $25 billion into highway construction. What that meant is that people could get to these suburban homes. So there were these huge federal programs that were stimulating housing growth that both the Trump and the Kushner families benefited from at a time in America where the social contract was very strong. Taxes were high, income inequality was relatively low, but the Trump family and the Kushner family, Joe Kushner's son and Fred Trump and his son Donald Trump, started to corrode that system from the inside by making massive political contributions in ways that they thought would help their business. And also in both families, we see this threat of tax evasion, of not paying back to the government that enabled these family businesses.
So let's talk about that. How exactly did both Fred and his son, Donald Trump, become so embedded in the political networks of New York?
So in the 1930s, Fred Trump was a sort of a one-off builder. He would build a house, and he would sell the house, and then he would build another house, and then sell the next house, and that was sort of how he kept his business going. But he wanted to scale it up. So he went into a Brooklyn courtroom where a bankruptcy court was handing out pieces of a bankrupt housing financing business, and he wanted to get a piece of it. And he realized at that moment that the way that you get a piece of business from a Brooklyn judge is by strengthening your political connections. That began a decades-long practice in the Trump family of going to political fundraisers, of hiring the people that were associated with these Democratic clubs, and of being able to influence politics on a massive scale in New York. Now, let me be clear. In New York, real estate is a shady business, and every real estate developer in New York understands that you have to play the political system. But the Trump family were outliers, and official after official and report after report pointed this out to me, that the Trump family pushed the system to an extreme and contributed to the overall breakup of a system, of a contract about how government should work.
So this is what's unusual. You're saying that what they're doing is different from what other developers were doing in terms of this contract. What do you mean?
So if a politician calls a real estate developer and says, please contribute, they will do that. Just this kind of a rainy day fund. The Trump family was different. There were so many officials that I called in New York and I would say, do you know why Donald Trump gave this contribution? And they would say to me, oh, yes, I know, because he called me and told me. And he would say, I gave $20,000. Where is my permit, my bond backing, my regulatory relief, many things that he wanted. So it was very, very clear that this was a different sort of transactional and extremely transactional politics that the Trump family practiced.
This wasn't hint, hint. This was A to B.
Exactly, exactly. And that's what made it different, because it is largely hint, hint. Everybody understands it. Nobody ever says, I am expecting this particular benefit for my large contribution.
Both these men, Fred Trump and Joseph Kushner, an immigrant, not just an immigrant, a Holocaust survivor, they come here, they benefit from this post-war era, lots of government money being pumped into development that they benefit from. But it's actually, you're saying, this aspect of undermining the government that they both also practice, and which in some ways they come to, or at least Donald Trump in many ways, comes to, I guess, seize upon as the problem with America is government.
Right. So you get to this point in the middle of the last century where the Trump family and the Kushner family were establishing themselves. And it's actually a sort of high point of wealth equality in America for a variety of reasons. But that produced a backlash. So very wealthy people began pouring money into the political system to both lower taxes and to undo campaign finance regulations. And the apotheosis of this was the Citizens United decision in 2010, which really obliterated, to a large degree, almost all campaign finance disclosure regulations. And that was the backdrop for Donald Trump coming into power, both his own abuses of funneling money into politics, but also benefiting from a system that had been broken by wealthy billionaires who really did not want there to be any regulations. And Donald Trump just sort of walked right into that and took advantage of that in his 2016 campaign.
In 2010, as you mentioned, Citizens United happened. It played this huge role in the 2010 midterm elections. You yourself were doing political reporting for WNYC and The Takeaway at that time. And you went to Stark County, Ohio, which was a hotly contested congressional district at the time. We have a clip of your conversation with the Democratic congressman at the time, John Bocchieri, about the changes he was seeing in those midterms. Here's what he said.
Folks are uneasy. They're uncertain. They're concerned about the economic mess that we just came through. And they're being made more anxious, quite frankly, by the special interest groups that are out there spending money to confuse people, disorient them. And that's been the most tragic part of this.
So tell us, who were some of the special interest groups you were seeing on the ground in Ohio at the time?
So that was such an interesting political reporting trip for me. Really a turning point in my understanding of money in American politics. And in fact, I write about that particular reporting trip in my book. So this was 2 years after Obama was elected. And Obama was elected, and it's all hope and change. Then I go back in 2 years, and everybody's mad, and everybody's angry at government. And I'm wondering what could have happened. And I'm sitting in my hotel room, actually, working on preparing my segment for Takeaway, and I start seeing all these political ads. And the message is, government is bad. Government is horrible. Government is your enemy. Constantly, all day. And as I am traveling around the country in that political season, I see that it is everywhere. These ads are flooding the system in a way that they never had before. And that's what Citizens United unleashed. So if you are playing ads 24/7 that say to people, government is terrible, government is the root of all of our problems, it's no wonder that when you have an election and you say to people, is government bad? They're going to say, yeah, government's terrible. It's the root of all of our problems, because that is all that they are hearing.
How was Trump able to exploit that message on the campaign trail?
He completely capitalized on that sense of grievance in a whole variety of ways. One is through his well-known message of us and them. So he would divide people. He announced his Muslim ban. He would speak out against immigrants. But there was also a way in which he would say to people, they're out to get you. They're not working in your interest, meaning Washington. I'm going to upend that. I am going to change the system. I am going to drain the swamp. One of the big applause lines in his speeches during 2016. Of course, now what has happened is we're seeing unprecedented levels of money coming into both the Trump campaign and also to pay President Trump directly. We see it every day at his hotel, where foreign leaders, businessmen, companies seeking mergers show up ostentatiously at his hotel so that President Trump knows that these people are paying him directly, paying his business directly, from which he's still profiting. So the floodgates are lifted and the money is pouring in.
But if the president isn't really doing much to lift up white working class voters, why are they still sticking by him?
What we've seen is an unprecedented assault on the truth. And there is no hearth where America gathers. There are so few trusted sources of local news. There's such a split, and the stories that people are hearing are so different. So if you are a Trump supporter and you watch Fox News and you follow the president's Twitter stream, you're getting one view of America, a view that the Washington Post has just pointed out consists of 16,000 lies and misrepresentations since Trump took office. 16,000. We're at the level of 30 a day. So where you have this ongoing assault on the truth, it becomes very easy to argue to people that they're living in an alternate reality.
But finally, if people in Stark County, Ohio, white working class voters who are so valorized in the political discourse, if they've had 3-4 years of a presidency like this, what does it say about how they value economic concerns versus maintaining their place in the racial hierarchy?
Well, I think that it's an incredibly complicated story. And I think one of the reasons why it's incredibly complicated, and one of the things I really try to show in my book, is this did not start with Trump. Economic inequality and destruction of the social contract started decades ago. Democratic and Republican presidents have participated in these systems. And when I say that I am looking at choices we made as a nation, I'm looking at all of the choices. I'm looking at the things that Bill Clinton did when he was president, the trade agreements that he sponsored, the Welfare Reform Act that he sponsored. There were all kinds of ways in which working class people of all races were not served by governments over the decades. And that created a very fertile ground for Donald Trump to walk in and say to people, you've been betrayed, because that was their experience. What I think is unusual about Trump is the degree in which there is a divorce between what he's promising and what he's actually doing.
Andrea Bernstein is co-host of the WNYC podcast Trump Inc. and author of the new book American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. Thank you so much for joining me today, Andrea.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.